So the development of dams themselves and human intervention, and I would say anthropogenic intervention in the system, is threatening to cut off the connectedness of the Mekong Basin. And when I wrote this book, my goal was to develop a narrative that told the story of people, community level, people who are being impacted or affected by this expansion, by this investment-led growth, by dams and by what's happening around them. So I'd like to share some of those stories with you, if you don't mind. After that, we'll go into some discussions. The first story comes from the Golden Triangle. So here's where the update is, folks. And I'll get to the update after I tell the story, because something happened here just 10 days ago. That changes the end of the story. This is Gruti. His Thai name is Niwat Roykow, everyone calls him Gruti. Guru is a form of the word guru. So he is the teacher. He's kind of the old man of the Mekong in the Golden Triangle, although he's not very old. He's in his 50s, and he's been working hard at work to gather communities in the Golden Triangle in Thailand and in Laos, and to have them talk about how their livelihoods are being impacted by upstream dams, by fisheries depletion, by things like the Tesco Lotus supermarket, which has now come into his hometown of Cheng Kong in the Golden Triangle. And you can think of it as like a Walmart supercenter, Tesco Lotus, I think being a British company. How this supermarket is changing the way that people think about food and think about where they get their resources. Gruti often talks about the wetlands and the forests around him as supermarkets. And whenever Tesco Lotus came in, he said, okay, that's a supermarket, but your forests and wetlands and the rivers are your supermarkets. And this is a message that he disseminates to young people and farmers around him. So when I met Gruti a few years ago, and I'd known him for a long time, he started telling me about how when he was young, he would sidle up to his grandfather in the cold winter nights of each year to get close to the home fires in his village, in their home. And of course, grandfather got the closest spot to the home fire because he was the oldest. And going to sleep, the grandfather would tell him stories about Bulahang, the local legendary caretaker of the Mekong Basin and the Golden Triangle. And Bulahang, by my own personal interpretation, is that he's kind of like a Paul Bunyan-esque character. But instead of cutting down the forests, he was the steward of the Golden Triangle, battling off evil spirits and outside invaders. Mountains and rivers were created from his footprints as he moved through the land. Just as Paul Bunyan raised Babe the Blue Ox to be a giant beast, Bulahang raised the fish of the Mekong to be plentiful and gigantic and to provide for those who lived near the river. Where Bulahang rested, he created flat land and taught the people of the Mekong how to plant rice paddies and build fish traps. So one of the things that Gruti is known for is now he does it with social media. He'll just send out a big text message and say, come and gather, we're going to go protest against the Chinese engineers that are coming down into our portion of the Mekong and are surveying the blasting of rapids. In this portion of the Mekong. And if those rapids are blasted, then large cargo ships, and maybe other kinds of ships, such as China's Brown Water Navy, could penetrate deep down the Mekong into parts of Laos. And this is something that they're very much concerned about because they believe that some of these larger fish species, their critical habitats form on those rapids and in those rocks. I had a conversation with him about Bulahang when we were talking about Bulahang, and I made the suggestion that during this year's I'm going to back up a bit. Sorry, I messed up my order. That each year, children in this part of the Golden Triangle come to Gruti to learn about how to move forward with their lives. And he puts on morality plays, okay, making these giant Bulahang marionettes. So what I tell him, and it has to do with this, is that perhaps this year during the performance, Bulahang could encounter a dam on the Mekong and kick it down. And he says, yes, we will do this. And he proceeds to spread the idea to others sitting around the table. But I remind him, though, that China is regrouping its efforts to destroy the shoals just north of Chang Kong, where he lives, and canalize the river for the passage of large cargo ships. I ask whether his group is preparing to take action, and he says, "This time we will go out there again and stop them. We will have Bulahung behind us, and if Bulahung can kick the dam, then Bulahung can stop the Chinese." So this was a conversation he and I had on January 1st, 2015. And he's been hard at work now that the engineers have showed up once again. And I'm happy to say that last weekend an announcement came out that China has pulled out of its plans to blast the rapids. And so this is a victory. It's a victory for a community organization. It's a victory for civil society action. And Grootie is an example of a positive outcome coming out of this part of the world. Now, he's quick to say, hold on, the thing was canceled once 15 years ago, and it came back 15 years later. So let's, you know, keep up the fight. And certainly he will. My next story comes from a part of the basin that unfortunately individuals at the community level do not have the agency to react and adapt. And this is from a resettlement community in northern Laos, just north of the jewel of Southeast Asia, Luang Prabang. Who's been to Luang Prabang?
Yeah.
Right. This is kind of the best place to go for tourism, sitting alongside the river. This doesn't show kind of the UNESCO World Heritage Site, but it's a back view of Luang Prabang. And this is the ancient capital city of Northern Lao, of the Northern Lao Kingdom of Lansang. There are gilded Buddhist temples like this one, all the way, 63 of them on this small portion of land in the old town of Luang Prabang. There are refurbished French colonial villas that are now restaurants and hotels for travelers. And there are places where you can get the best croissant in all of Asia. So it's this unique result of Lao culture, of French colonial culture. Don't get me wrong, in this book I talk a lot about the ills of what French colonial culture did to the Mekong region. But it has produced probably one of the most amazing experiences anyone can have if they go to the Mekong region, if they choose to stay for a few days. But just upstream from Luang Prabang, across from the Paku Buddha Caves, and maybe some of you have been there, a river flows into the Mekong here called the Nam U. And on the Nam U, Sinohydro, one of the largest builders of dams in the world, a Chinese state-owned enterprise, is building seven dams, a seven-dam cascade. When my team and I were kind of surveying this part of the basin, we came across a resettlement village that from afar looked quite amenable. Homes were neatly lined in newly built grid-like organization. There was a lot of activity in this village. So we parked a car and we wanted to get out and talk to people who were adjusting to a new way of life in this village. So after we had parked, a few villagers approached us, and without any solicitation, a middle-aged woman opened conversation with a complaint. "We are suffering. We were forced to move here 18 months ago, and the dam company promised 2 years of funding for transitional assistance. So far, we've only received enough to cover 6 months. We don't have enough to eat." I quickly inquired whether she and other villagers were given land onto which to plant agricultural crops. "No, no. The company only offered land for the house and provided no fields for planting rice. We have no money, so we must walk back to our old fields and forests by the flooded village. We're old and it takes us a few hours to walk there." Other villagers gathered around. From how they treated her with deference, I could tell the woman was an important community leader. Another man beside her added, "By the time we get to our old fields, it's already noon. So we spend it only an hour or so working in the field, and then we have to come back." Now, one of the reasons why they weren't given land for productive agricultural activity is because the Lao government and the Chinese government, the Chinese developer, don't count what they do for their agricultural activity as productive agricultural activity. These are swideners. They practice what we would call slash and burn or swiddening agriculture. Upland rice on slopes that are cleared and planted in a shifting pattern year on year. We can get into the details of that later if you want. But she continued, "If we want to plant rice or other crops around the resettlement village, we must rent land from the village next to us. Since we have no income, some villagers who rent land have gone into debt. They are forced to leave the village if they can't repay. In our old village, very few people had the need to borrow money. Now more than half of these villagers are in deep debt. My colleague inquired with her about health issues in the village. As soon as we moved here, many of the village elders died. This was not normal. They were healthy, but they were also aging. And since moving here, 5 infants have died. This also rarely happened in our village. We're not able to take care of each other like we used to. I realized that this initial impression of a neatly organized space, new houses, a lot of activity in a village, was one of forced and induced poverty. That the livelihood situation of these people in this village was getting worse day on day, month on month. I continued to walk around the village, and I came across another woman who was turning bananas on a roasting fire. She said, "Our old homes were built with hardwood teak, and they never rotted." She pointed to the side of her home. "See how the termites are eating the side of this building? The Chinese used the cheapest wood they could find to build these homes, and we will likely need to rebuild in a few years." When I suggested that the dam company could reuse the teak from the dismantled homes in the flooded village to build new homes, she replied, "The Chinese took the teak boards from our old homes and sold them on the market." I spoke to another woman who was showing me around the kind of the barren, dry land around her home. And if you know about this part of the world, whether it's the Golden Triangle, Thai Isan, most of Laos, Cambodia, people plant gardens, kind of pantry gardens around their homes where they grow chilies, eggplants, tomatoes, things that are easily gathered for food purposes. So she said, "We planted gardens alongside of our houses, but now those gardens are dead. The dam company used hard soil to make the resettlement village, and it's just not fertile." Her home was located alongside the river, so we walked down a steep path to the river's edge. She said, "In our old village, accessing the river was easy. We could bathe, we could swim, and go for picnics on a sandy beach. Now we cannot even fish, because this part of the river belongs to the village next to us." Upon leaving the village that day, we came across the middle-aged woman to whom everyone else was deferential. And she, as we were leaving, she did put a smile on her face and left us with these parting words: "Come again, you're always welcome to tour our poverty." A situation very different from Grutis in the Golden Triangle. Now, the final story comes from the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. And the Mekong Delta offers kind of a mixed bag of futures. And its own future is one that rests on the decisions of Vietnam's government that's having a very, I would say, much needed conversation at the policy level on the future of the Mekong Delta. The Mekong Delta is a waterscape or a landscape that's very different from the rest of the Mekong. Life very much is on the water here. People don't have cars. They have boats and motorcycles. The portion of rivers and canals to roads is, canals and roads greatly outnumber the number of roads that can be traveled by cars. Markets originated floating in the middle of the river because of the lack of roads. So here's a picture of a market in the Mekong Delta. Some of you know there are many land-based markets now in the Delta. But how sellers advertise for what they're selling is they string their goods up onto a pole, and this tells those that are coming to market what they're selling. By and large, the Mekong Delta is the food basket of Vietnam. It produces much of the rice that Vietnamese consume, 50% of Vietnam's export of rice, 25 million tons of rice per year. 70% of the fish and the shrimp and other aquaculture that come out of Vietnam come from the Mekong Delta. And the same can be said for fruit. By and large, most of the farmers, the 18 million farmers in the Mekong Delta, plant rice. And they were put there over the last 3 decades to cultivate rice. And this over-prioritization of rice cultivation has gotten these farmers in a difficult bind. Some of these farmers now are producing up to 3 crops of rice per year. And this is done by building dikes around their patch of land, or a collectively large patch of land, effectively cutting off all natural water flow and the flows of sediment and other things into those diked off areas. This worked for a while, but as the soil became depleted, you've got to bring new resources in and pay for bringing those resources in to that land to get more out of it, when the Mekong system did it for free. And so much so that farmers in the Delta now are increasingly becoming under debt, or they're moving to Ho Chi Minh City, not far off, to the tune of about 300,000 people per year. All right, so it's a massive exodus moving from the Delta to Ho Chi Minh City. And there are other problems too. As the sea level rises, tidal effects send more saline water deeper into this patch of land. So remember, it's about the size of West Virginia. This threatens agricultural productivity. Now, some farmers have been able to adapt by converting to shrimp farming, which requires a brackish mix of salt water and fresh water. However, if sea levels rise, you can see much of this brackish zone is going to disappear. This shows the effects of 1 meter sea level rise to the Mekong Delta. What it doesn't show is how upstream dams also are going to impact this map. So you think about the Delta as a place where there's been kind of poor agricultural policy planning locally, upstream dams taking sediment out of the system, which feeds agricultural zones through natural flood-like processes, and then coastal forces coming up from the ocean. That there is a very unique set of threats that are threatening to disintegrate this part of the Mekong. And we don't know what this is going to look like over time. But what we do know is there's ways to improve resilience in this part of the world. And importantly, there's something that should be stopped right now, and that is groundwater extraction. So groundwater extraction arguably is the greater threat to livelihoods and the geological integrity of the Mekong Delta than climate change. Because when you take water out for agricultural purposes or for urban use, and what's happening now is the tune of 1 million cubic meters per day are coming out of the Delta's aquifers. This causes the aquifers to sink, and the land above it will sink as well. These dark spots here show the rates of land subsidence, or land sinking, for 2015. Ho Chi Minh City that year sank more than 4 centimeters. Okay? Coastal delta zones sank as much as 2.5 centimeters. Sea level rise rises at about 3 millimeters per year, which is the greater threat. And these work together to disintegrate this part of the world. Now, to get to stories of people who are coping with changes, I found a friend of mine, Wing Ming Guang, who's a professor at Guntao University, and he said, we're going to go here to talk to some farmers who are coping with change. So this is Gulaozong Island at the end of the Mekong. And I was pretty stoked because we're going to go see the ocean. We're going to see the end of the Mekong. And we get on a motorcycle. First, we try to find the end of the Mekong. And we get stuck in a sugarcane field. Then we push our motorcycle through, and eventually we come to a big patch of mangroves and no beach. Because naturally, on the Mekong's coastline, mangroves have grown. And that helps keep the delta geologically intact. It prevents these storms from coming in and sending so much water in that it rips away at the coastal zone. We didn't find any beaches, but we did find some mangroves. And then we went back to a local cafe where we met Mr. Nguyen Bung Zet, a local sugarcane farmer, who had 180 hectares of land that he plowed. This is a large patch of land. I'm not sure how big that is in acres, but you know, it's a sizable patch of the Washington Mall, if you will. So when asking him about farming on the island, Zet told me, "We used to grow rice here in the past, but do so no longer. The land around here is young and used to be underwater, so it has a high sulfur content. So this young land is highly toxic. And if new water isn't coming down through the delta and flooding it and flushing this toxicity out, the land itself becomes very toxic and hard to conduct agricultural practice on." He says rice just won't grow there. People on the island have shifted to other crops, like sugarcane, taro, chili, or pumpkins. And for those who are rich, those who have money, they can dig out shrimp farms. But many people here are poor, so they don't have the ability to do that. I asked Zepp what he did for a living. Like most people here on the island, I plant sugarcane, but it's hard to find workers to come and harvest the fields, since the young generation tends to move to Ho Chi Minh City to work in factories. There's a huge shortage of workers here. Low numbers of workers means wages are too high, and I can't hire them. That's the problem. The price of sugarcane is very low this year. I have no income. Many of the farmers here have no income because we get less than what we invested into the farm. I cannot harvest my fields. We are very disappointed. I asked him about, you know, shifting into shrimp, something to create a higher value product. He said, trying my luck on shrimp also isn't an option. I'm too old. Anyway, to become a shrimp farmer, I'd have to surrender my land use certificate over to the bank to get a loan. Half of my friends who have gone into shrimping have failed. After that, they lose their land and have no choice but to work in factories. This is a gamble I'm not willing to take. So now I drive a motorcycle taxi, and that's why I'm waiting here at this intersection. Life is tough for Mr. Zepp. 180 hectares that he cannot harvest. Now, the final story is some positive innovation coming out of a half hectare of land. So on the same island, Guang took me to meet Mr. Tang, who cultivates a small patch of land for a closed system polyculture farm, where he's producing things that produce income almost every day for him. He doesn't have to wait to harvest, say, a rice crop or sugarcane crop. And he set this thing up over the last 15 years, and I'm happy to tell you about his story. Mr. Tan took us behind his home to give us a tour of the farm, which had two ponds surrounded by mangroves trees. They were filled with fish, carp, tilapia, and also snails, and floating plants called water lettuce. That's this here. Surrounding the ponds and his house are 80 fruit trees, bearing grapefruit, durian, and mentang fruit. And this is my first time ever having mentang fruit. It's this tart, lychee-like fruit found in the hotter parts of Southeast Asia. Every product from the farm would qualify as organic, and his system is entirely closed, meaning he brings in nothing from the outside of his farm, no pesticides, no fertilizers, no antibiotics, to maintain his productivity. So he said to us, the fish and the snails eat the lettuce for nutrition. All the fish are herbivores, so they will not eat the snails. My snails are top quality and highly sought after by restaurants in Cantu. And he told us this as he pulled a few snails the size of golf balls off a water lettuce plant that he removed from the pond. And then he took more water lettuce and put it into this wheelbarrow and wheeled it over to a 3-meter long concrete tube that was closed on one end. So this is my second trivia question, and he was very happy to show us this. What's this? You read the book, Sarah. Anybody? Okay, Sarah.
It's a biogas digester.
Yeah, it's a biogas digester. So he says, this is my biodigester. It provides all the gas we need for cooking heat, and it covers our air conditioning bill during the dry season. And he was telling this as he was taking that water lettuce and shoving it into this hole. And gas would collect in a system at the end and be sent through this tube. And seriously,
oh my gosh,
it was providing all the cooking heat he needed, and he could convert it to fuel that would run a generator for air conditioning needs in the dry season. And the other byproduct is kind of the waste product can then be put into the pond to feed his fish and the snails and the other things that are living in the pond. He says with a big smile, every year college students from the University of Minnesota come here to learn my methods. I teach them how to build a biodigester. My friend Guang added that Mr. Tan's fruit grows at different times of the year, and his fish and snails can be harvested at any time. So he's not like a rice or shrimp farmer who can only collect income a few times a year. On average, he earns between $5,000 and $6,000 a year, which is just over two times the Vietnamese per capita income. And if we think about Mr. Zet, the sugarcane farmer, who basically, you know, scraping by with 180 hectares of land, this is a much better system. I said to Tan, you seem to enjoy this, but maintaining the system looks like a lot of work. And he says to me, no, I really enjoy this, and it's not a lot of work. And now the system can take care of itself, and sometimes I don't have to tend to it for weeks. And what does he do in the meantime? He gets on a motorcycle and he goes around to the rest of the Mekong Delta teaching people how to do this, where he also gains income from this process. He's a proud man. So this landscape